You are listening to WNHNLP 94.7 in Concord, WNHNFM.org. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty.
And this is Statehouse Watch.
And we are here from the American Friends Service Committee New Hampshire program, from which we bring you every Friday afternoon or evening, really, the Statehouse Watch newsletter so that you can track the goings-on of policymaking at your statehouse. And then we're here every Monday.
This is Monday.
Yeah, thank you. 5 p.m. live from WNHN with our Statehouse Watch radio program, which rebroadcasts on Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m.
And you can find podcasts, which I think is a fancy word for recordings of this show and a lot of the other shows that are broadcast here at the station at the website WNHNFM.org. Just click on the programs list, scroll down to Statehouse Watch, and you can find – in fact, you can not only find last week's show and this week's show, but you can find an archive going way back. This is the beginning of our eighth season, Maggie.
Yeah, eighth year. And there are podcasts from when, do you think? Or do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But we could.
A listener can go find out.
Yeah, someone can let us know. Right. Find out what you can find out there. So.
And usually this time of year, we start our program by saying, woo-wee, there's a lot going on.
Maggie, there is a lot going on.
There surely
is. So last week, the House met for 2 days. The Senate met for one. They went through some, I don't know, 150 or 250 bills or something.
Wow.
Over the course of a couple of days. These were all bills that had been retained in House committees or re-referred to Senate committees, which basically means the same thing, but they just have different words for it. And they all came back to the floor with recommendations. In some cases, this is the one that I think find kind of amusing, Maggie, is the bills that were re-referred in the Senate, which meant that they were supposed to give it another look over and then send out a recommendation. And in many cases, the recommendation is, let's send this bill to interim study, which means let's put it on the back burner again and with a guarantee that we will give it another look before the end of the year, at which point all they'll have to do is say, yes, we think that this matter deserves further
study.
Attention, or we think that this matter has gotten all the attention it needs. And then that will then basically kill the bill for the year. But then after the election, someone who gets elected again in November can reintroduce something identical to or like any of these bills that, which had been in interim study.
That's right. Good. That was a good summary.
All right. All right. So that's – anyway, that is part of what's
going on. And so we were there in the hallways with a number of activists. Did you see the strong showing by Moms Demand Action? They were paying particular attention to a bill that addresses extreme risk protection orders that allows for the removal of firearms from the home of people convicted of certain offenses.
People suspect – not convicted of offenses, but people who are basically thought to be in danger – of harming themselves or other people, people who were, for example, thought to be suicidal. I mean, a huge number of the gun deaths in this state and in this country are actually people shooting themselves.
Mm.
So if we can find a way to keep people who are suicidal from getting their hands on guns, that is a way to help
save
keep
lives.
Them alive. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's a I think, a common sense proposal that did make it through the House. Of course, it's getting a lot of pushback. It does not appear that the governor is a fan of this, but it will now move over to the Senate. So a lot of these, again, if these were – some of these were bills that were originally House bills that had never gotten out of the House. They got stuck in committee, like the minimum wage bill that we'll talk about in a little while with our guest representative, Chris Schultz. And now that they've passed, they go over to the Senate, which will then assign them to committees and schedule public hearings on them. Other bills which had already passed in the House or Senate and then got re-referred or retained in committee – if those passed, then they get more into this process where do the House and Senate agree? Will they need to appoint a committee of conference and all that kind of stuff?
Yep.
So that gets into where things will go as we continue to move forward into the 2020 legislative session. This being the second year of the biennium, that's where things are at.
Right.
And since it is the second year, an even-numbered year, there's no budget to speak of. There could conceivably be some bills which have
pertain
an impact
to money.
On the budget,
yeah.
But by and large, those were dealt with last year. And by and large, legislators will say, we're not talking about that.
Yeah. Well, let me give a disappointing outcome from this past week, a bill we've been paying very close attention to that would HB 397, which would have created driver licenses for undocumented immigrants who are stuck in the limbo created by a Congress that is not sorting out a humane immigration policy. They would have been able to at least drive while they live here and go to work and care for their children, et cetera. That bill had been re-referred, as you mentioned, and was in the Senate Transportation Committee at the end of the last session, wherein it was amended to become a study committee. So we approved of that move for two reasons. One, there are some important issues that would benefit from discussion with multiple parties at the table, whether it's privacy or building support among law enforcement or showing the other benefits to our economy and to safety to extending this kind of license or building understanding with the DMV of why this is something that they could handle. But it was also a good step pragmatically because there's always some hesitation about standing up too strongly for the rights of immigrants. It's a hot button issue nationally, and there's definitely some fear among our elected officials of going out in front, taking risks on behalf of the.
So this was going forward to the full Senate, but simply as a proposal to study the issue. That was all it was.
Right. And that, even that, we found was just too terrifying for the Senate to be able to approve.
Yeah. Let me read a quotation from Bruno Suarez from the Drive Safe New Hampshire Coalition. He said, "While our families are being torn apart, it is heartbreaking to see people whom you would expect to be compassionate let their moral values be substantially outweighed by their desire to play it safe."
Yeah.
And then he says, "Life punches us really hard sometimes, but we've learned how to take the punches and keep standing."
And so
I think that was a good sentiment, and I think it says something about the strength of immigrants and immigrant families here who have had to put up with a lot.
And the determination to keep trying to keep moving forward and to insist on policies that keep all of us safe. So this issue will not be – it's done for this year. It's not coming off the table. It is dead. But the campaign for this humane policy is not over.
Maggie, are you aware of any other bills that have a significant effect on people who are immigrants or who came here as refugees?
We have at least two on the – I mean, a significant immediate effect, it's hard to say. But we have two bills this year that address the condition of undocumented immigrants in New Hampshire. One by Nicole Knight, which would assess the impact on New Hampshire families when someone in their family, a wage earner in their family, is deported. So we really appreciate her intention to illustrate, illuminate the multiple consequences and costs of a harsh immigration policy enforcement. And then there's also a bill that we're just learning about that would give people who have applied for asylum, would give them access to driver licenses during this 150-180-day waiting period that people are now living in before they get permission to work.
So if you are an applicant for asylum, you can get permission to work.
But it takes 6 months.
But it takes 6 months, and during that six-month period, you can't apply for a driver's license.
That's right.
So
this would be a very practical benefit for just an interim period.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll be a – I mean, who knows what will get ignited by such a common sense, modest proposal. But we'll be there to support that.
Great. And didn't you say, Maggie, that the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Support also had its eyes on another proposal?
Yes, they have a couple of – they're stepping more into the into the advocacy realm. But they have their eye on a bill that has a hearing on Wednesday that would create a dollar-for-dollar match for SNAP benefits, that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, for those dollars to be spent on fresh fruit and vegetables. So this aligns nicely.
They're interested in that because they have a farmer's market.
Exactly.
Where a lot of their members are farmers and they sell produce at farmers markets.
Exactly. And trying to encourage more understanding about the benefits of getting one's fruits and vegetables in that kind of an economic market.
What an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Now, Maggie, I know that you have your eyes also on a couple of bills that affect landlord-tenant relations and the ability of tenants to be able to live, to pay rent and such. And
yes, let me say them super quickly, and we'll talk about them more next week when we can reflect back on the hearing.
What happened? But
My state rep, Casey Connolly from Dover, has introduced a bill, HB 1247. It has a hearing tomorrow, Tuesday at 11 a.m. in the House Judiciary Committee. This is a bill that would require landlords to give tenants 90 days notice if they are going to increase the rent. I think it's 5% or more than 5%. And this really comes out of stories that Casey's been hearing from renters that suddenly, you know, in an increasingly tight housing market where a lot of building of luxury condos is driving up rents across all kinds of housing, that people are being faced suddenly with a multiple $100 rent increase and not being able to pay it and being on a very short timeline then to find something else in a housing market that sometimes is less than 1% vacant. So a very important opportunity to talk about the reality that renters live in and the effect, the impacts on households when your housing is so subject to the whims of a free market that is not not aligned with wages, let's just say.
Yeah, we'll just say that, right. In fact, we'll talk more about the minimum wage in a little while. But I'm planning on bringing to the Senate Commerce Committee tomorrow a chart showing how much rents have gone up in New Hampshire over the period of time since 2009 when the minimum wage in the state has been stuck at $7.25 an hour.
Great.
So,
Very good.
All, you know, we can make a calculation each year of how many hours a person would need to work at the minimum wage in order to be able to afford that level of rent.
Well, maybe you could bring your same chart to the House Judiciary Committee first in the morning. And then bring it to Senate Commerce
that
in the afternoon.
That might be. There's an idea. We'll see about that. If I can get it done in time.
One chart,
Maggie,
two hearings. Let me quickly say there are two other housing-related bills that have a hearing on Wednesday. One is a horrible bill. It's HB 1511. It's very punitive. So right now, if a tenant is facing eviction, they will have to not only, in order to not be evicted, they currently would have to pay all of the past due rent plus a $15 fee. Mm-hmm. This bill would say that the tenant has to pay not only all the past due rent, but a week's worth of additional rent. And in New Hampshire, that's $250 to $450. So it makes it a lot harder for somebody to what's called cure their eviction, much more likely to have that eviction be, you know, go through. And then on the good news column, just to end on the good news column, there's a bill, HB 1539, also in Judiciary, also on Wednesday, that talks about a process by which children living in housing that has found to have lead will be relocated. So that proposal comes out of a long bit of very thoughtful work advocating for greater lead safety and greater responsiveness in New Hampshire.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Maggie.
Yeah.
If people are interested, again, in what's going on, there is a lot of – this is the week that all of the committees are active scheduling hearings, so things are going to be fast and furious really until the end of March with a lot of hearings and a lot of work going on at that level. You can find out more details about bills, particularly that we think are related to concerns about social and economic justice in New Hampshire, by reading State House Watch, which you can subscribe to by going to our website at afsc.org/NH. Easy to remember.
And it's right there.
And then they'll email it to you, or you can you can go there and subscribe. You can also read it on our website in the Take Action section of the website at the same URL if you didn't get it in the email address. One other bill I just want to mention that's coming up for a hearing tomorrow, I believe. It's called
– what's the topic?
It's called HB 1251, Relative to Participation in School Sports Programs for Female Student Athletes. This bill is part of what you could call the scare about students who are transgender. And this idea that there's some horrible thing that's going on with boys pretending to be girls and trying to being involved in school sports. The Transgender Justice Program of the American Civil Liberties Union is opposing this, and they'll be there at the hearing, which will be taking place at 10 a.m. tomorrow in the House Education Committee.
Yeah, and I mean, you and I have harsh words for this bill. It's transphobic. It comes from a terrible place of exclusion and discrimination. But I thought Polana Belkin's quote, she's a trans justice organizer for the ACLU, had a very compelling, more kind of a mainstream argument, just talking about the value to students of participating in sports and being on teams, and why would we ever want to restrict
that
for them.
All right. Maggie, how about if we take a music break?
Good idea.
And then we'll be joined by Representative Chris Schultz. I think Chris Schultz will like this song by Layla McCalla.
All right.
This is the Capitalist Blues.
The stakes get higher. I've got the capitalist blues. When I give everything, I won't have much more to lose. I am swimming in an ocean of sharks. They are telling me how I'm gonna make my little mark.
Capitalist blues, it ain't fair, it ain't right to have to put up with all this strife. I thought that was a good intro.
Yes.
Welcome back to Statehouse Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty.
Did you already
say your name? Okay. And we are in the studio with our friend and one of Concord's best reps, Chris Schultz. Oh. Welcome back.
From down the street.
Yeah, from down the street. We're in your district right now.
You can throw a rock into my district almost. Yes.
But we would not do that.
A nonviolent rock.
We are not rock throwers.
We'd throw seeds into your district.
Yes.
All right, there you go.
So, Chris, are you a second term rep? Or third.
Technically,
now.
I guess this is considered my second term. I came in midterm in a special election.
Okay.
So, but I feel like I've been there longer. Yeah. You know, a legislative year lasts longer in yeah. the psyche, but anyway.
Well, and you're showing leadership on a lot of different fronts. So there's lots to talk about in terms of the minimum wage issue, the work that you're doing with the Progressive Caucus. But we want to jump in on a bill that lifts up a bit of really important labor history.
Thanks to Representative Casey Conley, who you mentioned earlier.
Yeah,
who's Maggie's representative.
Yes.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I am a co-sponsor of a bill to have a commemoration of the nation's first all-women strike in the United States. Labor union strike was in Dover.
That's right.
From the Cochico Mills girls.
That's exactly.
The Dover Mill girls. They were 12-year-olds through 25-year-olds, and they worked 11-hour days. So child labor laws, you know, we've got other hourly wage laws are covered, you know, and how we've changed over the years thanks to labor unions. So that's going to be an interesting bill to bring some enlightenment.
Yeah, what an opportunity to tell an important story. I know it's a story, Arnie, that your partner Judy Elliott has spent some time mm-hmm. telling. Do you want to add any details?
Well, just to say that, I mean, it's important to lift up that the they called themselves Mill Girls, and it was in Dover, but also later on in Exeter and Manchester and Lowell and Lawrence and all over, all these little mill towns in New England, where girls and young women organized for a 10-hour day. And they had petitions, they had strikes, which they called turnouts. They marched on the State House in Boston, and I believe possibly also in Concord, and they had an impact.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting, very, very interesting story.
And what struck me looking at the bill was it hadn't dawned to me before that they were doing this in December in the
Ooh.
Winter. So they weren't
wow.
choosing like balmy June days.
Yeah, right.
But also what I love about this story of the Dover Mill Girls is, and Judy first pointed out to me, a headline or some commentary from the op-ed pages of the Foster's Daily Democrat describing these young women as otherwise respectable, but that they had kind of stepped out of their proper behavior in
right.
order to stand up for themselves.
Right, so we all often still have to do that, it seems. And
yes.
and Chris, you stepped a little bit outside of things.
I mean,
you
I
were
did.
Still within the
otherwise
realm of things, but you definitely challenged, I think, the leadership, really even of your own party, by insisting that New Hampshire's minimum wage ought to get up at least on a schedule where it would get to $15 an hour.
Yes.
So there was a bill that was your bill got downgraded when it was retained in the House Labor Committee.
Right.
And went from being a bill that would lead to a $15 minimum wage to being a $13 minimum wage. And that's how it came to the floor
yes.
on Thursday.
And this was – there's a lot of details like that the sausage is made that people don't need to know. But all above board, of course. But it took a lot of conversations, a lot of elbow grease from our activists who support a higher minimum wage. It took a lot of conversations with leadership, connecting labor leaders to leadership of the Democratic Party in the House. Now it's going to be a lift in the Senate, which is fine. We have Senator Dan Feltes' support, which is good.
All right.
But we have a lot of hard work to do now to get it passed in the Senate. But I can give as much detail as you want or you have time for.
Well, so, yeah, maybe put it in context a little bit. This was it the first time that the New Hampshire House had ever voted in to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour?
Well, there was an amendment to a $12 minimum wage bill that I led the fight on, was the sponsor of that amendment, and it went down with almost 80 votes.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of went down in flames, and it was a tough fight.
Yeah, I
remember that. I did as much as I could to make sure folks knew who would be upset about this fight, because bringing a floor amendment to a bill when you're not on that committee or you're not leadership of that committee or it's not sanctioned by a committee is kind of rabble-rousing. So I did a lot of work behind the scenes to make sure I preserved my relationships, gave them the heads up ahead of time, make sure they knew it wasn't personal. This was about the issue and the activists and what the movement of the fight for 15 is.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest pickups that helped it pass, I think, was that relationship building that activists had with the chair of the Labor Committee, Brian Sullivan, Representative Sullivan. He did announce just hours before – or not even an hour before the vote, he had announced he was going to vote with us. And the way that it went, by having it as an amendment rather than trying to fight against them and vote down the committee's amendment, we got to just vote yes on that.
Yeah, people voted yes on everything. So first, it was just interesting. First people voted, Maggie, first they voted yes for the version
13.
That would have it rise to $13.
Yep.
Then they voted yes.
By a voice vote.
Then they voted yes on another version, which would have only raised it to $10.
That actually did not pass, right?
Oh, that's, well, that's true. That one
it failed.
That one failed, but it but people some people voted
some people
yes
voted
on that
yes
one.
For all of it.
Oh, yeah.
And then they voted yes on Chris's amendment to then raise it back up so that it would be on schedule
yes.
over five steps, I believe.
I changed the steps
so instead
to make
of
it
topping
more palatable.
Out at, so instead of topping out at $15 in 2024 as your bill was last year,
yes.
it now tops out at $15 in 2025,
yes.
which also, as I understand it, mirrors the Raise the Wage Act that passed the U.S. House of Representatives
yes.
with support from New Hampshire's Representatives Custer and Pappas.
Yes, which I think made a difference.
Which
absolutely.
I think made a difference there.
And then we passed the bill with higher numbers than the amendment passed. So we
all
picked
right.
up people between those votes. And it the way that just the relationship building and taking a non-agonistic approach, taking a community builder collaborative approach,
great,
I feel is what made the difference.
All right, great.
Which
I
learned from you guys.
All right.
Oh, beautiful.
Well, let's say a word about what were the arguments against this taking place?
You know, I'm glad that Representative Flanagan spoke. I encouraged him to ahead of time.
just to make it clear.
He made some interesting points if you
well,
wish
let me
to
just
share
kind of
any.
Play one little piece. This is Representative Jack Flanagan, a member of the House Labor Committee.
The most driving force, and I think you heard it here, was it's not a livable wage. And I've said before numerous times is that minimum wage is for the people that have no skills and that the employer is taking a chance on the employee.
Wow.
Yes.
Did I hear a little bit, not booing, but just kind of complaint?
Actually, what you heard, Maggie, was typing from my computer while I was recording that. That's what you heard there.
But
it was interesting.
Yeah.
Now, there was some dissension because this was just one of those little interesting things that happened on the floor of the House last week because one of the representatives got up and made a statement in which he said that the problem was employers were being unwilling to pay people an adequate wage. And he was actually told by the Speaker of the House that he should not be insulting the reputation of any business leaders
right.
in New Hampshire. And then, but then when Jack Flanagan got up and said that the only people getting minimum wage are people with no skills,
right.
One of the representatives got up and tried to say that that was insulting to people in New Hampshire and that the speaker should also be ruling that out of order. So that got a little bit chaotic there.
Yeah,
and
there's some fallout from that too. But I think overall, the folks that took the lead on the bill, not just me, it was a whole bunch of people in a movement that you guys are involved in too. We kept it on track. We kept it focused.
Positive.
And I think the main point I wanted to hit home right at the end, and Rennie Cushing, Representative Cushing, helped with us too, is that the people who earn these wages at the low end of our economy are not just working poor, but many of them receive public assistance, which is the worst way to get paid. You know, why not provide dignity and respect?
That's right.
And not let corporations or businesses get a backdoor corporate welfare. Why put the, what shouldn't be shame in our opinion, of course, but too many feel shameful to collect these public benefits. So,
you are so
well,
right.
I think it's shameful that our large employers are, in a sense, being subsidized by the taxpayers for paying wages that are too low.
And in a way, stealing the labor of people.
And we got Republican support on both the $15 amendments and on the final vote, especially Representative Betty Gay and Representative Bob Elliott, both of whom deserve our gratitude.
Thank you for naming them.
Now, you've mentioned Maggie's Representative Casey Connolly, so I've actually got a little clip of this is Casey actually speaking against the proposal to have the wage be $10. So let's see if I could cue that up here.
Mr. Speaker, colleagues, I rise today in opposition to the proposal to raise the minimum wage, but only to $10 an hour. This proposal is well-intentioned, but it amounts to an unconditional and unnecessary compromise in the fight for a living wage. When the clock struck midnight on New Year's Day, the minimum wage went up in Maine, it went up in Massachusetts, and it went up in Vermont. In Maine, the lowest hourly wage is $12 an hour. In Vermont, it's $10.96. In Massachusetts, it's $12.75. Here in New Hampshire, of course, it's $7.25, but if this measure were to pass, New Hampshire would still have the lowest minimum wage of any surrounding state. I ask why New Hampshire workers should earn less for their labor than the same people in corresponding states. Last year, this body approved an incremental increase to the minimum wage to $12. We all know what happened next, and there is no reason to believe a $10 an hour wage would have any different outcome. The reality is we can control only what we do in this chamber. And I ask for supporters of a minimum wage to support a wage that you truly believe in. New Hampshire workers deserve fair pay for their labor. They deserve a paycheck that meets the basic needs for themselves and their families. Based on that premise, 13 or even 15 already amounts to a compromise.
That's right. 15 won't be enough when we get there, but so I'm glad Casey pointed to the
right. And of course, his reference to what happened last year is that even the bill to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour was vetoed by Governor Sununu.
That's right.
This idea that somehow our lawmakers could bring it down to a low enough level that he would actually sign it, there's no evidence to indicate that that's the case or that that would be meaningful.
That's right.
Right. And what's interesting, too, about and I'm glad that you played that by Representative Conley because he's been fantastic. The Progressive Caucus, for the first time, did a whipping procedure. This is the part that hasn't made it outside the circle yet until right now.
Your listeners are hearing it first.
Yay.
Exclusive. Right.
That we have members on every committee, and most of our folks did volunteer over the holiday season to contact fellow committee members and gauge where they were. And that was really helpful. We followed up with targeted information if they weren't sure. It also helped reinforce the message that I think SEIU, the Fight for 15 committee over there, also made a lot of calls. So having both those efforts was very helpful. And so if we didn't have fellow progressives working with the whole Democratic caucus, I'm not sure if it would have passed. I think it helped make a difference, and Casey is a part of that, so I'm glad you played that.
Well, you're a representative of a very thoughtful inside game and a good partnership with movement folks. Do you have, as we focus on kind of the outside game, can you – not that it's a game, it's just that's a turn of phrase – do you have guidance for how we can strengthen the message for the Senate fight that will be coming?
Yes. I think it will be key for us, again, to identify where folks are. I think we need to line up our support of business leaders, because we do have a group of business leaders who support fair wages, that having folks from their districts contact their senators would be very helpful, and connecting business leaders to especially Democrats, but Republicans also, to say, hey, we've made this work. We, like the teetotaler, Emmett Soldati has been a very outspoken advocate as a business owner himself for paying his workers $15 an hour or higher. And heck, Target gets to $15 an hour this year. You know,
wow. So company-wide.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we need to keep echoing the successes in our economy, because where that has already occurred, as you well know, those economies are thriving, and New Hampshire deserves that too.
Mm-hmm.
I think
people with more money to spend, putting it back in.
And we have a high number of small business owners by percentage of the workforce compared to other states.
Right. I do think that one of the things that did make a difference this year was that the minimum wage had just gone up in all of the surrounding states and in a lot of places around the country, and that got a lot of attention, or like lots of news stories that, the minimum wage is going up in Massachusetts, it's going up in Maine, it's going up in Vermont, it's not going up in New Hampshire.
The timing actually was ideal.
Yeah. And then Representative Conley mentioned that, and also Brian Sullivan mentioned that in his testimony on the floor. So I thought that that was something that had some impact there. So tomorrow at 2:20 p.m., I believe, is it, or 2:40
p.m.? Yeah, 2:20 p.m.
2:20 p.m. in room 100 of the State House. That's tomorrow, Tuesday. The Senate Commerce Committee will be having a hearing on a bill introduced by Senator Donna Soucy. Now, I have to say, Senator Soucy has been a strong champion of raising the minimum wage through session after session after session. So this is maybe like the 10th time or something that she will have introduced a bill.
Yes.
Her bill would raise the state minimum wage, would first reestablish a minimum wage. It would raise it to $10 an hour next January, and then raise it again to $12 an hour in January of 2023. And I think that we'll be there as part of the New Hampshire Alliance for a Moral Economy.
Good.
Cheering it on and saying, how about an amendment
one more step
that adds one more step And that would be in 2025, raise it up one more notch to $15 an hour, which would be consistent with the bill just passed by the House, as well as consistent with the Raise the Wage Act that was passed by the U.S. House in Washington.
Yes, with support again of Congressman Chris Pappas and Congresswoman Annie Custer, which I think is a huge endorsement for this.
Absolutely. So. I want to make sure we mention, too, Arnie, we've said this several times, that real strength to this movement for higher wages will come from the authority with which low-wage workers can speak about the cost of low wages and the impact on their lives and the challenges of working for so little pay. So we seek opportunities to accompany those folks to tell their stories. Right.
And of course, part of the problem is that people who are working in low-wage jobs are generally have a hard time getting to the Statehouse in Concord
at 2:20
p.m.
on a Tuesday.
That's so true. And the Progressive Caucus, by the way, I'm going to have a training for us, and I might even open it up to the rest of the House members, but how do you reach out to your constituents, and how do you talk about income and class issues, and how do you recruit and highlight the voices of low-income workers, by the way, some of which are also state reps.
Good point. Yeah. Thank you.
Anyway, and you've got certainly a lot of constituents here on the Heights in Concord in your district who are working in the retail sector and working in the food services sector and such. And I wonder if even just sometimes you're able to, you know, be out there with your smartphone and record some interviews with people.
We should.
We know if you can't make it to the State House, we'd love to have you come. But if not, tell me what you think.
Yes.
And then maybe you could come and play those recordings for your members of the legislature.
The stories that highlight the families that are enduring these much too low wages and the struggle, you know, to highlight the basic math of this is really important.
All right. Well, good.
Because otherwise we, you know, have a tendency to marginalize and other people.
That's
we need
right.
to highlight the people who are enduring this. And there's unfortunately
and how
quite
hard
a
they're
few.
Working.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Good. All right. Well,
so is it worth just asking Chris to flag one or two other priorities for the Progressive Caucus? You are the chair of the House Progressive Caucus, are you?
Yes.
Is that your title?
Yes. I will admit I've been so focused on minimum wage, but we will be holding more agenda-setting meetings in the coming weeks, as well as planning possibly some action around the presidential election. But we will continue from week to week to highlight all the progressive bills that are coming through the House.
Very good. Great.
Well, keep us posted on that, and we can describe some of those in our State House Watch newsletter when they're coming up. We can certainly, you know, put a little tag on it to say this is being supported or this is being opposed, for that matter, by the New Hampshire House Progressive Caucus. We'd be glad to do that.
Great.
Chris Schultz, thank you so much for joining us on State House Watch.
And for all your work.
Right.
Thanks
and,
for having
good,
me.
Drive carefully as you drive all the way back home.
Great. When and see you tomorrow, probably.
We're going to take a little musical break right now, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Lila Corman-Glazer from 350 NH to hear what that organization is doing with regard to how to change New Hampshire's energy infrastructure in the interest of the climate.
And
so
they're
speaking,
on fire.
Speaking of coal.
Drag lines at my heart, they're tearing us apart, and the mountainside where we were born. Must I weep and mourn for the land it took 10 million years to form? Now all my eyes can see are just the bleeding scars across the mountainside, across the mountainside. Coalport, PA, just a little town tucked too far away for anyone to know. But the folks born and raised for six generations, working day by day, trying to keep themselves a home. Drag lines at my heart, they're tearing us apart, and the mountainside where we were born. Must I weep and mourn for the land it took 10 million years to form? Now all my eyes can see are just the bleeding scars across the mountainside, across the mountainside. Our neighbors down the road, they farmed 12 acres, worked a heavy load, poor as dirt though they tried, till the coal company came through, said, we'll mine your land, take the burden off of you, and we'll see that you get by. Drag lines at my heart, they're tearing us apart, and the mountainside where we were born. Must I weep and mourn for the land it took 10 million years to form? Now all my eyes can see are just the bleeding scars across the mountainside, across the mountainside. First they tore down their home where their grandma and all the kids were born. They just brushed it all aside. Then came the big machines, ripped up the trees and muddied all the streams, while the family stood and cried. Drag lines at my heart, they're tearing us apart, and the mountainside where we were born. Oh, take warning that the storm clouds will come and block out the sun that's shining on the folks who seek their fortunes off the families who have died, trying to survive across the mountainside.
All right, that was the New Harmony Sisterhood Band with Drag Lines, a beautiful song about the damage that coal mining causes to the environment, even just getting it out of the ground.
What a
before
beautiful.
We even think about what happens when we burn it and the CO2 goes up into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
This is Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty.
And we are joined on the phone by Lila Corman-Glazer from 350NH. Hello, Lila.
Hi, how are you?
We are great.
Hey, Lila, how are you doing? Happy New Year.
Good. Thank
you. All right, well, good. Lila, why don't we start out by asking you just to say a couple words about 350NH, what the organization is, what it does, and what are your priorities for this current period of time, and then we can get into a couple of details looking back at some recent activities and looking forward.
Great. My name is Lila Corman-Glazer. I'm the director of 350 New Hampshire Action. I'm actually here today representing. And we are an organization dedicated to bringing 100% renewable energy to the state of New Hampshire. That means we spend our time fighting to stop frack gas pipeline expansions and to shut down things like coal plants and to bring in renewable energy solutions that are going to save regular everyday people money and make our air and our water and our climate that much cleaner and safer for us. We are also running a program to get out the vote for a climate champion for president and for governor coming up, and have been on the trail of the candidates for the past year, pushing them to take bolder stances on climate wherever we can.
Great. In fact, last year we played a great recording of you going after
Beto O'Rourke.
Beto O'Rourke, yeah, which I thought that was a great example of how that can work. So anyway, thanks, Lila, for that. But let's, before we get into talking about the pipeline and talking about the upcoming elections, I want you to say a word, because you've been involved in this effort to use the techniques of nonviolent direct action to actually try to shut down the coal-fired power plant in Bow, New Hampshire, called Merrimack Station. For years, we've had all sorts of legislative efforts and other things to try to make it burn and, in a sense, be less harmful or more benign. But this is actually saying it's time for this thing to stop. And if the government's not going to stop it, we're going to do it. So could you say a word about how that campaign has developed?
Yes, absolutely. And I will just add that for folks listening who are familiar with 350.org, the national organization, and Bill McKibben, a national icon, if you will, 350 New Hampshire is actually an independent state organization. So we're not legally or financially connected to that national org. Absolutely. Thank you for asking, Arnie. And I will start this off by saying that I have never been a rule breaker. I think very much the opposite. I have always been a rule follower. And this year, I had the pleasure of being arrested in Bow at the last coal-fired power plant in all of New England without a shutdown date. And I actually sat in the police van with my mother, who had been in retirement from activism for about 40 years, but who has come back out given the urgency of the climate crisis. And for folks listening who didn't know that there's a coal plant in New Hampshire, you're not alone. There is a coal plant in Bow, New Hampshire. It is the last coal plant in all of New England without a shutdown date. It provides about 1% of our electricity, yet New Hampshire taxpayers are paying millions of dollars a year to keep it open. We are subsidizing this plant. A private company in Connecticut that owns the plant is getting rich off of the pollution of our air and our water.
So Lila, are you saying that in addition to the rates that we pay to Eversource through or whoever through our electric bills, that we're also paying subsidies from tax dollars for to a bunch of basically hedge fund owners in based in Connecticut?
That is exactly correct and exactly unfortunate. And so one would think, barely provides us any electricity. Studies show we could replace this plant with local renewable solutions that would actually save us a lot of money. It's polluting the air and the water for people who live right around the plant. It's destroying our climate. Why would we still have this plant? And, when I look at that, when I try to answer that question, what I see is decades of failure by our elected leaders and by industry leaders. I just see decades of failure. And I got involved in climate activism about 8 years ago, and I never could have imagined the climate movement being so big or so strong. And yet I'm still here 8 years later because we're not winning. So this summer, a group of activists from across New England, we've got folks participating from grassroots groups in five plus states, came together and said, we're going to take action on our own to shut down this coal plant. We're tired of waiting around for our elected officials to take action. We're tired of voting in the people we think are right and then watching them do nothing. We're going to take action into our own hands. And that is why we have started a wave of nonviolent direct actions targeting the plant and more recently targeting train deliveries of coal to Bow. We have trains coming up from West Virginia in eastern Ohio carrying 10,000 tons of coal to New Hampshire. And, just the song you played, I can't stress enough that the extraction, the mining, the processing, the transportation, and the burning of coal at every single step of the process, people are dying and more people are going to die in the climate crisis if we continue to burn coal. I, for one, cannot sit by while New Hampshire continues to burn coal, when I know that for every hour that that plant goes on, people living frontline to the climate crisis will suffer and die in the immediate and near future. And quite frankly, if that sounds desperate, good. It is desperate. It is desperate times. And I invite every single person here listening to start acting. Like
great.
It.
This is State House Watch on WNHNLP. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. Lila, for folks who haven't been paying close attention, just describe briefly the actions that you all have taken then in the last couple of months. Has it been 4 acts of civil disobedience? Just give us that rundown.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's actually been 6 or 7 now.
Wow.
I have to stop and count. But started off with actions at the State House and at the coal plant this summer and this fall. We've had over 100 people arrested at the coal plant and on train tracks in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, physically blocking coal trains from delivering coal to New Hampshire. We are the No Coal, No Gas Coalition. We are a grassroots group of grassroots groups from across New England who have come together under the leadership of, individuals and organizations to shut down the coal plant in Bow because it's 2020 and we don't need coal and we can't afford to burn it any longer.
Great. Lila, you mentioned that it's not just no coal, it's no coal, no gas. So let's shift a little bit and talk about the Granite Bridge Pipeline. What is that and how is 350 New Hampshire Action approaching that project?
Yeah, absolutely. For those listening who haven't heard of it, the Granite Bridge Pipeline is a proposal to build a 27-mile fracked gas pipeline from Exeter over to Manchester and a 2 billion cubic foot storage tank in a residential neighborhood in Epping. If that sounds terrifying, it absolutely is. If it sounds unnecessary and expensive, it absolutely is. This thing would cost ratepayers to the tune of $440 million with a big fat return for Liberty Utilities. And again, I think, you know, we're seeing more candidates and more elected officials start to wake up and realize that burning frack methane gas causes climate change and that the only appropriate and moral stance to take is to stop increasing our infrastructure. But we are still seeing people, well-meaning people like Dan Feltis, the state senator running for governor. We're still seeing people like Dan Feltis who talk the talk on climate and who I think legitimately care, be on the wrong side of this issue. I've had the chance to talk to Dan, and he has told me that he cares, and I believe that he cares about my future, but actions speak much, much louder than words in these cases. And Dan Feltis is on record supporting a massive frack gas infrastructure expansion project. And so one of our focus points in the campaign is getting candidates and getting elected officials to publicly oppose the Granite Bridge pipeline and any frack gas infrastructure. And, you know, really drive home that point that if candidates want the support of young people, if candidates want the support of people who care about the environment and the climate, then they have got to stop giving in to the fossil fuel industry. Our elected officials have a choice right now. Dan Feltis has a choice. He can continue to side with Liberty Utilities and the fossil fuel millionaires and billionaires that are getting rich off of the destruction of New Hampshire's communities, or he can choose to side with people like me and you and our listeners who are here fighting for our lives, fighting for clean air and clean water. And if he wants our support, he's going to have to choose us. Yeah.
Lila, before we get to the election, say a word about what is actually the regulatory process that's necessary that would either allow this pipeline to get built or would stop this pipeline from getting constructed.
The Public Utilities Commission, who are three people, basically appointed by the governor, and then the Site Evaluation Committee, same situation, are the people who have the final say on this project. The regulatory process is currently delayed over a year. They should have had an answer a year ago. They don't, in large part, due to grassroots resistance and the resistance of our allies at Conservation Law Foundation, who are there with lawyers intervening. So right now, it doesn't look great for the Granite Bridge pipeline proposal. It's been stalled out for months. We are not sitting back and waiting for the Public Utilities Commission to come out with a decision, though. We are out there proactively talking to people along the route, building public opposition, educating the public, and pushing our elected officials to simply do better on this issue. And this is by no means liberal purity test. This is a question of, do you stand with the fossil fuel industry or do you stand with your constituents who you say you represent?
So if I want to say a hell yes, I stand for the climate and for our future, then what are the next two or three things I should do? How do I support this movement?
Thank you for asking. So you can get involved by going to 350nh.org or 350nhaction.org. You can sign up on our website to get involved. We're actually having a call tonight. So if anyone is like, I just heard this and I have to get involved right now, 7 minutes from now, you can join a mass call with 350 New Hampshire activists and find out how you can get involved. For information about how to join that call, you should go to our Facebook at 350NH, and you can find the event starting at 6 p.m. tonight. Otherwise, feel free to send us an email. You can find contact on the website, and we can get folks plugged into any number of local chapters or campaigns.
And you got a bail fund set up that we can contribute to?
If you want to contribute to a bail fund, you should go to nocoalnogas.org. That's nocoalnogas.org. That is where donations are being collected for legal and direct action proceedings. You won't find that on 350 New Hampshire's website because we are part of, we are just one group in a large coalition. So again, if you want to directly support a bail fund or something like that, you should go to nocoalnogas.org.
All right, great.
Awesome.
Awesome. And just quickly before we go, I understand that Governor Sununu has put out a new energy plan of his own. Have you had a chance yet to scrutinize that?
I haven't read it yet. I will say I am not optimistic, but I do think that it is a good sign that he put one out. A couple of years ago, Governor Sununu was saying things like, I don't know if climate change is real. I'm just not sure. I'm a scientist. I've studied this, but I'm just not sure. And so the fact that he has done an about face and a 180 enough to put out a renewable energy plan is an impressive show of people power. Does that mean we should support him? Does that mean it goes far enough? Absolutely not. Governor Sununu took about $150,000 from fossil fuel industry and energy corporations and their lobbyists in 2016 to get elected. And as a result, he goes around acting like he represents them instead of us. So if we want to do something good for the climate, Governor Sununu has probably got to go. But in the meantime, you can go to 350nh.org and get involved with our campaign.
Lila, you are a phenomenal spokesperson and movement leader. Thank you for this time and all the awesome information you've given us. And you can go get ready for your national call, and we will be definitely following you and staying in touch on these important issues.
All right, great. We are finishing up this week's episode of State House Watch. Maggie, what would you like to say about things that are coming up in the next week?
Just that there's a lot coming up. My mind has just suddenly gone blank. Yeah. It's full of hearings, lots of hearings. Voices of Faith will be at the State House tomorrow, Tuesday, in the morning and in the afternoon.
All
so
right. Good,
we are welcome.
We've got, this is now the third annual Women's March, or is it the fourth annual Women's March? I'm losing track of that. But there will be one in Concord outside the State House from noon to 2 on Saturday. Is there also one taking place
in
the seacoast in Portsmouth?
Yep, that's right.
And,
you're ahead of me in terms of your clarity about the details.
And perhaps others on that, but we can try to find that out, and we'll certainly put them in the State House Watch calendar. We're also coming up on Martin Luther King Day, and I'm now calling it Martin Luther King Days because I've been putting together a calendar of events going on, and there's things happening on Saturday, there's things happening on Sunday, there's things happening on Monday, there's things happening the following week. Let me mention a couple in particular. I believe that Maggie Fogarty will be the guest speaker at the annual Martin Luther King Day service sponsored by the Dover Area Religious Leaders Association. Where and when will that be, Maggie?
It's at the auditorium of the Wentworth Douglas Hospital at 7 p.m. on the 19th with a theme of Forward Together, Building Beloved Community in These Times.
All right, great.
And then where will you be, Arnie?
Well, I'm speaking at two different events. I'll be speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of the Eastern Slope in Tamworth, New Hampshire, and that will be on Sunday evening at 6 p.m., I believe.
Yeah, 6 to 8 p.m.
6 to 8 p.m. there, and I'll be talking about the significance of the struggle to get a Martin Luther King Day holiday in New Hampshire and why it still matters. And then I'll be doing that again as the keynote speaker at the 36th annual Martin Luther King Day breakfast in Hollis, sponsored by Southern New Hampshire Outreach for Black Unity. And you can find out about these and other events on the American Friends Service Committee's website at afsc.org/nh. The other event that, of course, we're promoting is the 38th annual Martin Luther King Day Community Celebration, which will be Monday afternoon at Temple Adath Yeshurun in Manchester. And at that one, we'll be talking about the significance of the Poor People's Campaign from 51 years ago, but also what is going on now in the Poor People's Campaign and how we need to draw connections between the issues of racism, poverty, militarism, and ecological devastation, interrelated evils, which need to be attacked in a interrelated way in order for us to be successful. I think it's one of the things that we learned from Dr. King that we are still trying to apply. So next week, instead of being here, Maggie and I will be out, but we will have a pre-recorded show that will feature a 1968 address by Coretta Scott King, some interviews with local people, a little bit of Dr. King, and we hope that you'll be listening. Thanks for being with us on State House Watch. Till next week.
Bye.
Over.